Thank you for coming.
Pleasure. It's lovely. And you're all smiling. That makes me feel a lot more comfortable.
To start at the very beginning, you were born in 1969, I think. Is that right? In Renfrew, in near Glasgow. So if you're listening hard for a Scottish accent, you're going to have to listen very hard, because I think you left... How old were you when you left?
I came down here when I was 2 years old. So I had a slight cute accent, but very quickly lost it.
And you came down and you're living basically in the Annerley area, that's right, isn't it? Sort of Crystal Palace, Annerley. We've got a picture of your mum and your siblings coming up. There they are. And there's you, very cute little one in the middle, with you, flanked by your two sisters and with your big brother on the end.
Great haircuts.
Great haircuts. No picture of your dad, because presumably he was behind the camera all the time.
He was behind the camera all the time, yeah.
That's always the problem, isn't it, with family photographs. You get one person who takes all the photos. They never actually appear in them. But what was family life like? Tell me about that.
Well, to be honest, I don't, remember much in the early days, which is a little bit disappointing, even though I've gone to my other siblings to try and find out, what's going on in our life. But there's only just a few things that I actually do remember. I do remember, unfortunately, that my dad was kind of pretty much a distant figure. I don't remember, my dad ever, holding me or lifting me up or, that type of stuff. As a young boy, I don't think I ever played football with my dad. I don't recollect it. But I don't want to give bad press in, mate, but probably some stuff that maybe did happen, but I just unfortunately remember my dad just sitting at a table rolling cigarettes and giving that discipline.
So was it fairly harsh discipline you got?
Yeah, well, my dad, if you know anything about kind of Scotland and Glasgow and the Gorbals, that's where my kind of dad was born and raised. And he went into the army for a little stint and kind of kindly shared that with us, that type of experience. My mum was very different. She was more, she was more motherly, very cuddly, fantastic with a slipper. Could go around, she could spin a slipper around the corner. But there was that sense of, there was a sense of love. And I think, again, the difficulty is, we know that words are powerful. And I just know that all I kept remembering was, my mother's or my dad saying, children should be seen and not heard. So just a heads up, parents, as a young person, when you've got, there's this sense of insignificance. It's like, you're a child. Go over there, you have no opinion, you have no say. Despite the fact that, I did feel this sense of love from my mum, but, my dad was very, very far off. I did question him about this when I was older. And he said, I loved you in my own way. I don't know kind of what that was, but that's what he knew. So that's what he done.
But you were telling me the other day when we were chatting that you and your sisters had a habit of running away from home. What was that about?
I think the first time I ran away from home, it must have been 9 years old. I was 9 years old. I remember because I was in the second year of junior school, and ran away with a friend of mine and stayed at his nan's house. Thought it was a bit of an adventure, but I was 9 years old, and subsequently from then was running away a few times.
Why were you doing that? Were you running away from something, or did you just want a bit of adventure?
Good question, and one that you reflect and look back, and because unfortunately my memory is a little bit kind of foggy, I think that when you're brought up in a type of environment that's, like I said, it weren't harsh. My dad disciplined, but we weren't like beaten like really badly that some people kind of were. But it was very, very, very strict. And I just wanted to have this sense of belonging, or, you know, acceptance, and fun maybe is the manifestation of that. You know, whether it's trying to get attention, I don't know. But I just knew that when I ran away, there was this, this is good fun. Until I got home, brought home by the police, then yeah, it wasn't that funny after that. No, that's for sure. Where's Gary? Oh, there he is.
What about school? Where did you go to school?
I went to Malcolm first, and then we moved.
That's in Penge,
that's
that?
In, yeah. Yeah, so went to Malcolm Infant School, and then we moved to Annalyn. I went to Annalyn Junior School. It used to be behind the town hall.
And then on to Langley Park.
Then on to Langley Park.
Yeah, we'll get to that in a bit.
Good school that was. Yeah.
I think you're saying your father died was about 10 years ago, is that right?
It was around there,
But are you still in touch with your mum and your siblings?
I'm still in touch with my eldest brother and my eldest sister. My younger sister don't see much of. Unfortunately, it's the effect of being brought up in a broken home. And as I'm sure you, I don't answer the next question. Second guessing.
So you got to Langley Park. So you're at a good school, but seems life quickly started going pear shaped for you. Can you tell people about your remarkable story you were telling me about how? When you were invited to dinner at a friend's house, we should think, oh, that's a wonderfully positive experience, but it had a bit of a different effect on you.
Well, it was productive and counterproductive at the same time. I think the problem is when you've been brought up in a certain environment and you haven't been anywhere else, you don't know anything else, you're not aware of anything else, you just think that's the norm. So I was invited by a friend, and they were quite, you know, lovely family, middle class, lived off the back of Langley Park, Wickham Way, really, really lovely house, and was a little bit poor. And it wasn't that. It was the shock of sitting at a dinner table, firstly with everyone at the dinner table, and it's just the way that they were just talking, communicating, just general daily stuff that was going on in their lives, but it was the way that they was communicating. It was, you know, I'm interested in you type thing. I'm, well, how's your day? And what was, and asking me, and I'm, what's going on here? How do I respond? It's not like this kind of home, really. So it was very nice, but at the same time, it left me with a sense of feeling, you know, I wish my dad was like that. I didn't want another one. I just wish mine was like that. So you kind of, now I realise that, you know, there's something that, you know, is not quite right.
That's something missing in your life?
Emotionally, yeah, very much. And as guys know, we understand our emotions very well, don't we? you just know that stuff is going on. It's not good. But you obviously don't know how to address it because I wasn't taught anything like that.
So you've got some fairly sort of mixed up feelings, and expressed itself at school in a sort of not very positive way, and you ended up getting thrown out of Langley Park. What was all that about?
Yeah, that was a bit of a shame. It's quite a nice school, actually. apart from the rugby, didn't play football. I just knew, you know, by this time I was kind of quite off the rails, even though I was probably, I don't know, 11, 12, I'm not sure. I was just had this kind of destructive mentality. So obviously I wouldn't go to school. I was being pulled left, right, and centre. They're trying to get me in. I was being horrible to teachers, spitting at the headmaster, which really is not good. And he politely asked me to leave. So that was it. Yeah. So I was a young boy.
So where did you go after that?
Well, after that, I went into care after that.
Right, okay. And this is really because your parents had split up.
Yeah.
I mean, how did you feel about that?
Shockingly, not bothered. And I think I was 12, 13, I think, maybe 12, I think, maybe. I remember my mum calling me around the back of where she was with her new guy and explained the situation and said, you know, it's just not working to a 12-year-old, like I really understand. And she went, you know, I've left your father. What do you think about that? I just went, no. Nothing. No sense of loss, no sense of, that's bad. Why? What's the reason? It's just numb. Just, yeah, okay.
But then all four of you kids got put into care.
Three of you,
your older.
Yeah, my older brother, he was 17.
Okay.
So at the time, he's 5 years older than me. So he was able to stay out.
Mm-hmm.
But my two sisters and myself, we went into the care of Bromley, into a children's home, yeah.
And what was that like? Where did they send you?
Well, the irony is, they sent me kind of 5-minute drive from my house now, in Crofton Avenue, a place called Avonstowe Children's Home. That was the first place that I went to.
And that transformed you into a good little citizen, did it?
Absolutely. I'm so pleased I went there. Now, I had a kind of strange kind of moment, and I do want to clarify, I'm not a gangster, I'm not a drug dealer, I wasn't a clever, I wasn't going out to be like a mastermind criminal, you know, anything like that. I just made a conscious decision that I was going to just not do as I was told, because I, as much as, you know, there was issues with, you know, my dad and my mum was going a different direction, but, you know, for a young boy, I didn't ask for this. You know, I didn't, you know, this wasn't part, no one asked me my opinion. So I'm going to make sure that, you know, I'm going to be as naughty, destructive as I possibly can. And I did.
And you soon found yourself in a secure unit,
yes,
didn't you? Which is, that's basically the bottom rung of the sort of penal ladder, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. And I know I was 13 at the time, because they couldn't move me forward into any other institution because I was too
young.
So
what had you done to get into secure you?
I was just constantly running away from the children's home, rude, very, just not nice, just really, really not nice. And if I'm really, really honest, which I, you know, I kind of am now, by God's grace, it was hard work because I'm struggling in myself, because I'm not saying I'm a good guy or I was a good kid, but I still didn't, you know, there was a part of me I didn't like what I was doing. So I was kind of wrestling myself, you know, right, trying to, right, you know, they deserve it, keep being naughty, keep doing this. So it wasn't something that was natural to me. It was quite hard work to do, to be honest. Yeah, that's how I did. It took a lot of hard work, yeah.
Well, the government thought they knew exactly what you what you needed,
yes,
didn't they?
Very
forward
thinking.
We've got a little film clip here.
Two years ago to deter young delinquents from a career in crime.
This regime has taken its name from a phrase used by Home Secretary William Whitelaw in parliamentary debate 4 years ago. The system, he said, should provide for every boy going through it a short, sharp shock.
Change direction. Lift.
The felt like standing up.
Yeah, the short, sharp shock. So
it was.
Did it work for you? Did it turn you around?
No. It what it did do, it got me really healthy, got me really fit, got me really conscious and aware about how I could look after myself better. But to be honest, no, it wasn't. You know, I don't know if you're thinking. This is probably hard to maybe kind of explain, but the best way to say it is within my mindset, I was institutionalized already. I was already following a regime. My dad kind of laid down these rules. I was already taking these steps forward in order and discipline and all this type of stuff. So that was kind of what I was used to. And so they didn't dish out as bad as my dad dished out, so it wasn't as bad.
And you're saying at times when you deliberately would set out to try and make your teachers cry, and you'd succeed. How did you do that, and why did you do that?
It was anything to do with authority. Anyone who represented authority or was an authority figure. Because of, again, like you're a young guy, you're hurting, you're angry, you don't know how to resolve it. And, you know, no matter who it is, they're part of this big wheel. They're part, you're all together, you're all in it together. So anyone who it was, and I this is, you know, when we discussed it, and I thought about it many, many times. Because, you know, there's lots of things I've done wrong in my life. There's lots of things I look back at and I feel bad about, you know, and there's times that you think, you know, if you can make restitution, I would love to be able to do it. But when you reflect, I think, I just can't believe that I was that spiteful and horrible, that my objective was to make someone cry who was looking after me.
But obviously, there was turmoil going on inside you, because at 16 you had you attempted to kill yourself, or you thought about tried to.
Bad criminal, failed that as well. No, I got to a point, and again, this is the best way that I remember it. I wasn't sitting there thinking to myself, "Oh, poor me, poor world." Again, you just have this numb thing going on. It's like, well, can't be any worse, can it? I mean, there's no purpose in life. There's no goal. There's nothing that I've got before me. So at 16, I just thought, well, you know, okay. I'll just leave it there then. Wise decision.
So what did you do?
I took a razor blade and started to try and hack my wrists. And I was trying, honestly, I really, really was. I got scar to prove it. I was generally trying to make it happen, but I just couldn't. Just didn't happen, which was bizarre.
That's good for you and good for us.
Yeah, it is. It's good, yeah.
But over the next few years, you were in and out of prison. What sort of things were you doing? What sort of crimes were you committing, and where were you jailed?
Most of them were kind of car crime. It was just petty stuff. It wasn't, like I said, I wasn't going out to be like the intelligent bank robber robbing big banks and so. It wasn't. It was just, I am going to cause as many problems as I can. So if it wasn't bolted down, I'd steal it. If your car was left somewhere, I'll nick it. I'll drive it. And a lot of the stuff as well was violence towards police. Who I love now.
How did you cope with prison when you were in sort of the more grown-up institutions?
Inconvenience. It's not... for me, it wasn't a time where I would lie down and say to myself, this isn't good, is it? Because this is what I know. This is no one's... I know it sounds silly, you know, when you see the stuff on the TV and you sit there and you go, oh, hold on a minute, no, you can do that, you can't, because there's no option, you don't know another option. And the other challenge as well is because you cover up, you know, your low confidence, low self-esteem and all the other stuff with like, you know, kind of like a bravado and a facade that everything's all right, you know, sort of, mate. Because that's how you survive. So you push all the emotional stuff down and you just pretend that everything's okay. So did it really, you know, there's stuff that you gain, I guess. There's little moments, little windows of reflection. One when I was in detention centre when I read a little book called The Switch Cross and the Switchblade.
Yeah, well, that was made into a film.
It was
the
indeed,
book,
yeah.
Cross and the Switchblade. And we've got... The trailer for the film we're going to have a quick look at now, just to remind people.
just a country preacher, 300 miles from home. But I've got a message for you.
Hey, I got a message for you.
Is there anything in your life you'd like changed?
Yeah, I'd like to make the rich poor and me rich.
Now, I know there's some pretty tough guys in this crowd. You wouldn't be afraid to shake hands with a skinny preacher, would you? God loves you, Nikki.
You come near me, I'll kill you.
Yeah, you can do that. You could cut me up into 1,000 pieces and lay them in the street. And every piece will still love you.
So it's the, if you don't know it, it's the true story of David Wilkerson, who is this pastor in the States who felt called to go to New York and just get to know the roughest of gangs. It's a story of the conversion of this lad, Nicky Cruz. And amazing things happened. What impact did that book have on you when you read it as a 14-year-old?
I was 14 years old. It was my first spell, sharp shock. And I was literally just taken into into custody. And they, you know, they wheel a kind of little library round just to kill, to get your head adjusted. And I just saw the knife. I thought it was better than most interesting.
On the cover of the book.
On the cover of the book, I thought it was about the best book I can read in that library. And I read it. I remember reading it and getting to the end of the book. And again, it's those moments that I know that you look back, that they're the moments where probably God's not that far off. And I believe it, you know, for everyone. And I remember getting to the end of the book thinking, if only that was true. Because it seemed so removed from anything that I had experienced or understood.
But then a few years later in Rochester prison, you had a very profound sort of spiritual experience after going to a meeting in the chapel. Tell us about that.
Yeah. Came back from the meeting, and but prior to that, they had a Pentecostal church come in. It was all really wow, great, loud music, and there was a guy speaking about his experience as being an ex-offender, but I didn't remember that. It must have had an impact anyway, but I just felt this desire to I felt really kind of drawn to it, because the chaplain had said, by the time the service is finished, he said, look, you know, if you're interested in what you've heard or what you've seen, then write down your name on a piece of paper and stick it in a little box, and we'll kind of come round and, you know, we'll have a little chat with you and explain what you've seen. So I did. I had this bizarre, it was so strange. I was like, oh, hello, this is a bit funny, it's a bit unlike me. So I ignored it, you know, as most of the things I've done in my life up until then, anything with common sense. So got to my prison cell, and luckily on that occasion it was just me. And the only way that I can describe it a bit more better now. I was in the prison cell, and I just felt this presence, tangible, me picking this glass up and the reality that I know there's a glass of water. If I close my eyes and grab the glass, I still know it's there, even though I can't see it. And I could tangibly feel this presence in the cell. And before I knew it, I was on my knees in Rochester, wailing like a baby. Just, like I said, I wasn't brought up in a... My parents were atheists. There was no God. There was no Sunday school. There was no mention about God. Nothing whatsoever. But I'm aware that he's there. I'm aware that I'm asking God, who I don't know, to forgive me. And I had this sense of remorse and overwhelming shame and guilt, but not the one that makes you feel condemned. It's more of an awareness, a conviction that I wasn't, you know, I was in danger of, you know, going down. I was already down a slippery road anyway. But this lasted for probably maybe, could be 10 minutes, I think, just genuinely, like, depth of my being, this, it was really real, snot, everything, it was messy. And then I started to become aware that, hold on a minute, what are you doing? Do you know where you are? Now, I'm not saying like I'm schizophrenic, but it was almost like I was having this conversation with myself. There was a part of me, I'm not saying no out-of-body experience, nothing like that. There was a part of me that was on the floor that I was having this experience, this genuine, I'm really sorry for what I've done thing. And then the other part of me that's going, people can hear. This isn't good, stop it. What on earth are you doing? And that didn't go on for too long. And again, tangibly as I felt this presence come into the cell, I felt again it gone, and I was left with me. And then the next thing I'd done, in every kind of prison cell, there's a Gideon's Bible. So I picked up my Gideon's Bible, opened up my Gideon's Bible. I don't know where I opened it, but I opened it somewhere. It's probably the Old Testament or Leviticus or something like that, more than likely. Started reading it, I was like, I don't understand that, and threw it on the side, and that was it.
So, no hugely profound change, because you're facing more prison, for some more years to come. So it's an experience, but one that was just history.
When I become a Christian, I can understand. But at the time, and you know, like I said to you, John, I may have done, but I don't think I ever mentioned it again, because I just didn't know what it was. I didn't get it. I just didn't. Even though I was saying, God, forgive me, and I knew what happened, I just didn't think about it.
But eventually, you'll all be relieved to know, you did decide this was a bit of a mug's game, and you'd go straight.
Yeah.
So were you 21?
I was 21 years old.
So was that really it? You just decided it wasn't worth carrying on like that, or what?
The person I was with, my partner at the time, she'd become pregnant with my first daughter, and that really kind of impacted me, because I hadn't, you know, because of the type of person that I was, you think that you're okay, but you know, I wasn't treating her well. And I wanted to be a good dad. I knew I just really wanted to. And like I said, sorry, Dad, but the reality is, I know he tried to do what he thought was right, but it wasn't right. It wasn't what a child needs. So because I know what that, of course you don't, do you? You think you know. You think you know, because I was so taught well about parenting. So I got all the tricks up my sleeve. No, I just told myself, do you know what? Whatever, above all, I just want to make sure that she feels loved. That's it.
Now, what did you do for work at this stage?
I started, because I had accumulated silly convictions. I think I had amassed about 40 by then. So you're kind of limited where you can go. It's either building or catering. So I opted to go for the catering. And then I ended up going, I started off washing dishes, actually, in Churchill Theatre. And then ended up running there. It used to be a carvery if you ever used to go. So if you went in there 23 odd years ago and I was carving the meat, there I was. Big knife, great.
And were you good at
Very sharp.
And were you good at it?
I was, because there was order. I loved order. I didn't realise it. And do you know what? That's the funny thing that I've learned as an ex-offender. That, you know, when you talk to people who are ex-offenders, or they're in the midst of it, and you try to bring structure and some sort of purpose and definition, they kick at it because it's like, no, I don't want to do that, but you need it. You take it away, there's chaos, there's nothing there. So I like the regime, and that's the only way that I can call it. On the early days, it was like a little regime, and I quite enjoyed that. Didn't mind doing 12 hours a day and plus. I was okay with it.
That's great. We're going to take a 10-minute break now. But for the moment, David, thank you very much.
Thank you.